Well, I want to welcome you, please, ladies and gentlemen, I'm supposed to do that, to the Commonwealth Club Psychology Forum series of talks. My name is Patrick O'Reilly. I'm delighted beyond measure to introduce Tony McAleer for this talk. He's a former organizer for the White Aryan Resistance. Tony Mack served as a skinhead recruiter, proprietor of Canadian Liberty, which was a computer-operated voice messaging center used to disseminate messages of hatred, and he was the manager of the racist rock band Odin's Law. However, it was love for his children that finally led Tony on a spiritual journey of personal transformation. Currently, he's the executive director of Life After Hate and shares his practice of compassion as an inspirational speaker. So please welcome our speaker for tonight. Thank you. All right.
Thank you for having me. And everybody can hear me fine? So I'm the executive director of Life After Hate, and you may wonder, what is Life After Hate? Life After Hate is a nonprofit formed in Chicago in 2011. It was an online journal before then, founded by six people who are all former member leaders and members of the extreme far-right racist movement in the United States. And our goal is simply to help people get out of the place where we once were. So the mission statement of Life After Hate is to inspire individuals and communities to a place of compassion and forgiveness for themselves and for all people. And in this climate today where the country is divided and it seems to be that the middle is gone and there's extremes on both sides and there's a lot of dehumanization going on, as well as the threat of terror from other parts of the world, I want to share with you my personal journey so that you can understand at a human level how people get drawn into these groups and how people can leave them. So you may wonder, I grew up in a middle-class family in the wealthy part of Vancouver, and my father was a psychiatrist. That maybe explains a little bit. I grew up in... I went to private schools. I didn't come from a broken home. There was no violence in my household. But I was this bright, sensitive... If you can think back to the time when you were young and came into this world before life really happened to you, the core essence of who you were. I was bright, sensitive, mischievous, stubborn, defiant, curious little kid. Growing up in a household where it wasn't safe to be emotionally sensitive. Like I said, there was no violence in my household, but coming from a British immigrant family, there was a lot of stick given about verbally. In England, it's verbal and emotional violence is a national sport. England's, and this is how you preserve a class system, England's great promise to every one of its citizens is they promise you someone else to look down on. And that's how you keep a class system intact. And so that verbal... meanness and viciousness was something that I grew up with. And growing up like that, being a sensitive kid, I learned to kind of stuff the emotions down. And, you know, there was stuff in the household, but, you know, if I go back to where things really started to change for me, I go back to probably about the time when I was 10. And I walked in on my father with another woman. Now, can you guys, anyone here remember, and ladies, the day that God fell off the pedestal for you? And that left me really angry and confused. And I went from a straight-A student to a C student. And I was 11 years old at a Catholic boys' school, and the teachers had tried everything to motivate me. And they called my parents into the office one day, and they said, you know, we've tried everything. And I think this was my dad's idea. Why don't we try and beat the grades into him? And I remember what that was like. I'd be 11. And the stubborn part of me wouldn't give him the grades. I'd get just close enough, but not enough. And he'd be handing out the exams or the assignments, and I'd be looking at it like Texas Hold'em, and I'm just like, 72, I know what that meant. And I'd have to walk down the hallway and stand outside his office. And whether it was 2 minutes or 10 minutes, I always wanted 1 minute more. You ever been in a situation where you know something really bad's about to happen and there's nothing you can do about it? That was that. And he'd come walking down the hall. He'd let me into his little office, and I'd have to bend over at the front of his desk with his name there. And how about who's heard this one? This is going to hurt me more than it's going to hurt you. is that the biggest piece of BS ever? So I'm bent over the desk, and he pulls out a yardstick, and he whacks me. And I just remember, whack, whack. And I'm just like, I just wanted to be anywhere else but there. And then the next two come, and I'm like, I can hold it together. By five and six, tears are rolling down my face. And by the seventh and eighth time, it was never more than seven or eight, I was a blubbering mess, just begging for it to stop. To this day, I have never felt more powerless than I did in those times in that office over and over and over again. My grades didn't go up. And I went from listening to Elton John and Queen to The Clash and the Sex Pistols. And I continued to be that stubborn and defiant part of me. It's the Irish part, I guess. Call no man sir, my knee bends to no one. Gets me more trouble than it's worth. And I got shipped off to, and I wanted to go to boarding school in England. This is 1982, 83. And when I was there at boarding school in England, that's when I first got introduced to the skinhead scene. I was really into the punk thing because it was, the music was angry and violent. It really vibed with me and it spoke to me. And I was angry and not violent. I didn't grow up as a violent kid. But I got into the skinhead subculture there, and there it wasn't really racist. The origins of the skinhead youth subculture goes back to actually reggae and ska from the late 60s and the Caribbean community and the white community in East London. But there was a revival of it attached to the punk rock music. And I came back from England as a skinhead. You know, and if I look back at, and this is a great exercise to do, by the way, my father was, they say there's nothing more British than an Englishman abroad. And that was my dad. He had recreated his English pub bar with English pub mirrors, and he brewed his own English beer and had his English friends over to do things. And you know, for me, the skinhead thing was an ultra-British version of the punk scene. And what I did is, this is a question, ask yourself, are my behaviors or beliefs the same as my parents? Are they the opposite of my parents? Or are they actually my own? And a lot of the things that I did as a young man was to bond with my father, because even though he was there and he provided and loved us very much in that way, I never saw him. He worked 60, 70, 80 hours a week. And so I attached myself to the beer drinking, the Union Jack, the very Britishness. But there was one part that was the opposite of my dad, and that was Adolf Hitler. My father had been bombed by the Germans during the war, and he despised what I got into. But that was a way for me to be angry at him, is to idolize the guy who sent bombers to try and kill him as a child. It's funny how the ego works that way. So I came back to Vancouver.
We don't hate anybody. We're just proud of our race.
They get BET. Why can't I get white entertainment television?
It's about white pride, not white power.
Mexicans are stealing our jobs.
Black people are criminals and inferior.
Gays are an abomination.
All Muslims are terrorists.
A race war is coming.
Don't be deceived by these lies like we were. It's not too late to get out. No judgment, just help. There is life after hate.
You can't see that picture very well, but that's me up there. And these two guys, when I first met them, it was outside my first punk rock concert I was going to, and I'm wearing Doc Martin boots. They were a dime a dozen in England, but in North America, they were very expensive and very rare. And these two guys, I didn't know them at the time, came walking down the line. They looked down at my feet, and they said, "What size feet do you have?" I lied and I said 7.5, because I knew the reason they were asking was to see if they were going to fit them. And the one guy turns to his buddy and goes, "Nah, they wouldn't fit you." Literally quaking in my boots. And I remember going into the show. It was a great concert. But I left early because I didn't want to get beat up and robbed by these guys. Those guys became my best friends. And my bullying survival strategy was befriend the bully, become the bully. And I sought the solace in the eye of the hurricane. Now, in order for me to have their protection, I had to have their respect. In order for me to have their respect, I had to commit violence too. And I did. That's a picture of me in, I think, 18. The story that shames me the most around that area is when we participated in the bashing of a gay man. And we were 17. We were drinking at a park where gay men used to hang out. And we saw this guy and yelled at him and threw cans at him. And he told us to F off. And we chased him. And we chased him into a construction site. And he ran in. It was at night. He ran into the construction site and under something about as high as this into like a crawl space. It was too low for us to go in and chase him. And so what we did is we picked up stones. And like kids at the lake at summertime, we whistled these stones into the darkness. And I remember you could hear the clack, 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 ah! Every third or fourth stone, you could hear that man cry out in pain. And I wonder, what would it be like to be that man lying in the darkness, sitting in the darkness, knowing something really bad is about to happen, knowing they were absolutely powerless to change it. And I know because I've been in similar experiences, and it's this cruel part to human nature that takes awful experiences that we may have gone through and make us feel it's okay to project it onto somebody else. And that's probably one of the events that I carry the most shame about. And I want to say at this point, I don't blame anything on my childhood. I chose to do everything that I did. But human beings don't do anything without a payoff. And someone asked me this question, Tony, how did you lose your humanity? You seem like a nice guy. I didn't lose my humanity. I traded it for acceptance and approval until there was nothing left. The analogy I'd like to use is, you ever gone to the grocery store when you're really hungry? You notice you make different choices, right? And I talk in my experience. But I went out into the world emotionally hungry. And I made choices that seemed good at the time. And I share these stories with you, what happened, not to blame or excuse anything. I chose to do everything, but to give you some context as to why those choices might have made sense. That was me at Aryan Nations in 1987. And I went from being a non-political skinhead to being more and more political. And because each time I went a little further and a little more extreme, I got a sense of power. I got a sense of notoriety, being able to walk into a show or down the street and have people afraid of you. Because I wasn't a tough kid growing up. I was bright, but I wasn't tough. The people I were with weren't necessarily bright, but they were really tough. And for me, I was a big fish intellectually in a small pond, but I also got to feel safe and to intimidate people the way that I had been intimidated. I attended cross lightings. I was involved in California with Tom Metzger and the White Aryan Resistance. That name might ring a bell. With some of his skinheads that were with his group that killed an Ethiopian student in Portland that led to a $10 million lawsuit against him, which he lost. And I ended up on the Montel Williams show twice. You know, once in dressed like a skinhead in 1989 and once in 1991 dressed in a suit, you know, and getting rid of the skinhead attire, because I found myself with the media and everything that I was getting, I was a total narcissist. I was completely operating from ego, and I didn't care who got in my way or who got hurt as long as I could feel powerful. And if I could, and being able to do it with my words, being able to be on a talk show and hurt 10 million people at a time, that was intoxicating. But there's always needed to be more and more and more. At the age of 20, I said to friends, I'll be dead or in jail by the age of 30, and I'm okay with that as a white revolutionary. Stockpiling weapons and those types of things. And at the age of 23, I was with my girlfriend at the time. I'd been with her 3 months, and I met her through people in the movement, and she said the phrase that no 23-year-old guy wants to hear after 3 months when you're in the middle of breaking up with her, and that's, I'm pregnant. And I'm like, oh. And all I could think of was my mom, who my brother and I had, we referred to her as the beak, because she would always like peck at us, like, Tony, don't go out with her. She'll ruin your life. She'll get pregnant on you. She'll ruin your life. And as soon as she told me that she was pregnant, that's what I heard in the back of my head. So I was like, I can't tell. I can't tell them right away. I've got to delay this, as I'm a procrastinator by nature anyways, but I've got to delay this as much as possible. And I remember the day where I go, you know, I've got to do this. So I pick up the phone. Hey, Mom, it's Tony. Michelle's pregnant. You are. She's pregnant. I told you she'd do that. She ruined your life. You ruined your life. And I hear the phone on the curly thing banging against the wall and her footsteps going across the kitchen floor. And I've never heard so much profanity come out of the mouth of a middle-class English woman that day. Not of all my mom. And then I hear the heavier footsteps, and it's my dad, the doctor. Tony, what's your mom all upset about? I'm like, it's Michelle. She's pregnant. Are you sure? And I'm like, oh, yeah. He goes, well, how far along is she? 7.5. 7.5 months. I said, no, the contractions are 7.5 minutes apart. I'm calling from the hospital. True story. But what happened? I told you I'm a procrastinator. What happened next was I get handed, at the age of 23, this beautiful little baby girl. And she's got this little scrunchy face like this. And she opens her eyes, and I know that my face is the first picture that her brain is going to take. I know that in that moment, I connected to another human being for the first time since I couldn't remember when. Because here's what I've learned in my journey about dehumanization. And the level that we are able to and do dehumanize other human beings is a mirror to how dehumanized inside we are and how disconnected we are from our own humanity. And we go to those places because it's safe. We block it off because of pain, and it's the safe place to go. We numb ourselves. And in that moment, that numbing started to thaw. Because here's the thing about children. They're safe to love. They're not capable of rejection. They're not capable of shaming. They're not capable of harming and that, and at least not till they're 12 or 13, right? And that's all they want to do for a couple of years. But you know what they do is they give us compassion, right? That unconditional love. And in all the stories, in 2011, I went to the Summit Against Violent Extremism, which was put on by Google Ideas, which is now Jigsaw. And they brought in 50 former violent extremists from around the world. I just want to quickly show you a picture of my daughter before I move on. I had a son 15 months later. So at Google Ideas, they brought in 50 former violent extremists from around the world. You had the IRA, the Ulster Volunteer Force. You had FARC, Bider Meinhof, Red Brigade, Mujahideen, radical Israeli settlers, jihadists, you name it. To look at why do people get into these extremist groups and why do people leave? And they also included 30 victims and survivors, because it's, you can't have this discussion without including the voices of victims and survivors. And what I learned around dinner and just discussions at the side over a beer and stuff like that is I started to hear the stories were all the same. And the number one reason of those 50 people that I heard was the birth of a child. And the birth, it seemed to be anecdotally a female child. And I think there's something about the feminine energy being introduced into that hyper-masculine space, which is transformative. I think if it's a boy, I think all of a sudden it gets looked at as a young soldier, and it's treated very differently. But that shows up over and over and over again. And the other story that shows up over and over and over again in different themes is compassion an act of kindness or compassion from someone who we don't feel we deserve it from. In particular, someone who belongs to a group that we once despised or dehumanized. And I think of one of my colleagues, a guy named Arno. In his book, he talks about going into in Milwaukee to a McDonald's, and this elderly African American woman is she's at the cashier, and she looks down and she sees a swastika tattooed on his hand, and she looks at him and she goes, "Come on, son, you know you're better than that." And that really messed with him. Like, why does she care? Like, why? What? And so what it is about compassion that I've thought about is when we do that act of compassion, we hold up a mirror to someone, and through the lens of our eyes, they get to see their humanity reflected back at them. I couldn't see my humanity. My children could, because they could see it, I could see it. So when we do those acts of compassion, particularly when you don't feel the other person deserves it, and those are the people that need it the most. It's the hardest people to give compassion to, but they're the people that need it the most. We haul out that mirror and we can allow them to see themselves. Because in the way that we work with people and helping them leave extremist groups, we don't deal with the belief system right away, because the challenge is the ideology, and for me, the ideology and the identity are intertwined. You can't attack the belief system without attacking the identity of the person involved. You could, without attacking my identity, and my identity was all in. So I would deflect. I wouldn't take in. I wouldn't receive what you had to say because it threatened my identity. The ego will fight to the death to preserve itself. But the experience of compassion, it's experiential. And the mind doesn't know how to deal with that. And when you start to see your own humanity, you can start to see the humanity in other people. And so we look at this as a healing process rather than a re-education process. Once you connect people to their humanity, the ideology falls away anyways. And there's two steps in this process. They're long steps. One is disengagement. The other one is de-radicalization. So I'd left the movement behind. I was burnt out. And this is how the ego mind likes to twist things. The ego says, why should I care about a whole pile of white people who probably couldn't care whether I lived or died? I'd gone to the Supreme Court of Canada twice and exhausted. And I was, my inability to earn an income because I was so high profile affected the quality of life for my children. Because I was so high profile, who they could be friends with at school was affected. And for the first time in my life, I made a decision with someone else other than me in that process. And so I said to myself, why should I be like Don Quixote, jousting windmills? Why should I fight for a bunch of white people who couldn't care whether I lived or died? If I really want to do something for the white race, I'm going to walk away from this, and I'm going to make sure these two children thrive and survive. And that's how I justified and rationalized to myself to leave the movement behind, but keep the ideology and the identity. As I continued to thaw and heal and grow and put distance between me and the movement, but I still had a lot of the belief system still intact. I became a financial advisor in 2004, and in 2005 I was, you guys remember the movie What the Bleep Do We Know? Yes. Well, it's a great movie if you haven't seen it, but I started to get into like the law of attraction, and there was a guy locally in Vancouver who put on workshops about the ego, the mind, and how to get past your own self and your own barriers. And I went to some of his workshops, and I really hit it off with the guy. The guy is English. He's from Manchester. I'm from Liverpool. And we both love Monty Python and all these quirky little Britishisms that all of a sudden come out when two British people find another each other in a room. And my friend gave me a gift certificate for a one-on-one therapy session, a counseling session. And so I went into that and sat down on the couch, as you do. Never been to therapy before. And I'm telling him about the things that I'd done. I'm sharing with him stories like I've shared with you. And he looks at me, and he starts smiling. And I'm not thinking this is very funny. I'm deeply ashamed, and I've never told anyone before. Because I spent most of my time after I left the movement hiding from my past. And then I go, what's so funny? And he goes, you know I was born Jewish, right? And I'm like, no, of course, the irony of it. But there's that compassion piece again. And if it wasn't for him, I wouldn't be here today. He's the one that helped me heal and deal with all of the reasons why these choices made sense to begin with. But he was born Jewish. How could a Jewish guy love me, want to help me? You know, when at one point in my life, I wanted to annihilate them. I can't tell you how much it messed with my head. And the work, the healing work, wasn't easy. Wasn't fun. And he held me accountable. And there's an important piece to compassion and forgiveness that often gets left off the table. And it's why I think people abandon compassion and forgiveness, because it doesn't work. It has to be accompanied with healthy boundaries and consequences. And he held me accountable for the things I did and didn't let me off the hook and made me look at stuff that was uncomfortable to do and to speak in public about these things so that they can become learning points and help people heal in their own lives. So that's the work I did with him that's taken me. I worked with him 6 or 7 years before I was ready to talk publicly about what I did and be before you as I am right now. And at Life After Hate, particularly in this divided country, last 6 or 7 months, we've got 10 times more calls than we did in the previous 5 years. And helping people get out the challenge is when people join these extremist groups, and it doesn't matter what the ideology is, right? You know, if the research out of University of Maryland and their study of terrorism and responses to terrorism is that the number one correlated factor in the history of someone joining a violent extremist group is childhood trauma, right? And I think it goes beyond physical and sexual abuse, but emotional neglect and abandonment. So what is it about childhood trauma? And as young people, when those things happen to us, we develop a sense of identity about ourselves that's very unhealthy. John Bradshaw, if anyone remembers him, a great book called Healing the Shame That Binds You, he talks about toxic shame, and it's that perpetual belief that we have that we're not good enough, we're not smart enough, we're not lovable, we're unworthy, all of those things. And we go out into the world, and we live our lives in reaction to that belief system. Now, one way to react against that belief system of feeling less than is to become an overachiever, to prove to the world over and over and over again that we're greater than, that we're a winner. I can think of a very unpopular public figure that fits that bill exactly. The other one is we live up to it, and we become gifted underachievers. And that person had a brother died of an overdose, right? So there's different ways that the same thing plays out. One can join or grab an ideology that tells you you're greater than, and you spend your whole life immersed in a belief system that you're superior. There's different ways that it can play out. Childhood trauma is a horrible predictor for violent extremism, though. It's always there when most of the time with people that go down that road, but it's also there in a whole spectrum of antisocial behaviors. And it's interesting in that other video that we showed where it's not about white power, it's about white pride. So in the white racist movement, there's an awful lot of talk about pride, and pride is the opposite of shame. And when you talk to people that are ISIS or Al-Qaeda inspired individuals, for them, the word honor comes up all the time. And that's another word that's the opposite of shame. If you actually look at the young people that were arrested in Brussels and Paris, it was not their study of Islam and the Quran that led them to ISIS. They were troubled kids. They were all troubled youth. And so it's cognizant to remember that the human side to the story, and it's so easy to dehumanize the people. We can't afford to dehumanize them, because as long as we're dehumanizing anybody, we can't fully have peace within ourselves or around us. So I'm just going to show you. There's a video, another PSA that we did that recently won an Emmy, and I just want to play that for you. That was the event in Dublin with the formers from around the world. I think this guy who's an imam and this guy who's a priest travel around together. He only has one hand because his group cut it off, but they travel together working for peace. It was it really was a surreal event. That's the team that founded Life After Hate.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
This video, the two people in it, they both, you'll get it from the story, but they both came together, they met each other again, and that'll make sense to you in a minute, volunteering at the Museum of Tolerance in Los Angeles. And they made a documentary about their reconciliation.
That night, drunk, I was out there that night, drunk, stupid, and looking for a fight.
When my mom found out I was gay, I was 13 years old. She threw me out of the front door, locking it behind her, and that's the last time I ever saw my mom.
Someone yelled, "Get the faggot." I kicked him in the head and watched it snap back.
I remember looking into those eyes. The moment I saw him again, I had to think, can I forgive him?
I spent half my life thinking that I killed him. I feared what I didn't understand, and that fear turned to hate and violence. Hate is like a cancer that will eat you alive.
Until there's nothing left to forgive.
If you or someone you know is in the dark world that hate takes you to, we can help. No judgment, just help.
Does anybody have any questions? Why don't we... Okay, since November 2016, there have been a rise in hate-motivated incidents and crimes. What are you doing now to help address this problem? Whose question is that? That's fine. So what we're doing to address that is, like I say, we help people get out of hate groups. And one of the things that we do is we have a technology partner that can identify radicalizing and radicalized individuals, and we can intervene and reach out to them through social media one-on-one and try and begin an intervention type of outreach. We also take videos like this one and the first one, and we can drop them into people's Facebook feeds and if they want to watch a white power video, they have to watch one of our PSAs ahead of time. And we've had these academically analyzed. And we did a three-week trial with a think tank from London. And we got eight people in this tiny three-week trial that reached out to us that we then had ongoing discussions with to move away. Because the challenge is when you go into a hate group, you excommunicate yourself from your friends, family, and the rest of society. You know, and that's, you're not getting your needs met, so you're going to go and get them met in an unhealthy way over here. But when you leave this group, you basically have to excommunicate yourself from this group. And you end up in the middle, and I call it the void. And in the void, and I remember being in that place myself, and I developed and I built whole new social networks as I took my tech savviness from the movement and went into the late 90s into tech startups in Vancouver. And I remember hanging out at this Irish bar and the restaurant that had newly opened, and I got to know the owner really well, and there was this really cool energy and people there. And I remember going in one day after about 4 or 5 months of going there regularly. He said, I got to talk to you. I said, I've got 25 people who won't set foot in this bar if you're here. And all it took was one person to say, do you have any idea who that person is? And the whole social circle gone in an instant. And I accepted that as the price I had to pay for who I was and what I had done. and I share this really to understand for someone else trying to get out, that's a challenge that they're going to have to overcome. And it's the loneliness of being in that void is often feels greater than the complete dysfunction of being in those groups. Because I spent 15 years in those groups, and I'll tell you one thing. I can't think of a single person that was experiencing joy on a daily level. When you're in a place like that, and you're caught up in that negative energy and that hatred, and you're spewing it out all day long, your life's going to suck. Your relationships aren't going to work. And if you can't do healthy relationship with yourself, you can't do healthy relationship with anyone. And if you can't do healthy relationship with anyone, your employment, all facets of your life are going to suffer. And so we help people traverse that void. And we have a private Facebook support group that now is close to 50 former violent extremists that are now disavowed that, helping each other and new people come through to get to the other side and to lead them back to rediscovering their humanity. Because once they can see their own humanity, they can see the humanity in somebody else. What was the nature of the case before the Supreme Court? That had to do with the Canadian Liberty Net, which is a telephone hotline. Now, in the old days, people used to use a single answering machine. You called it, you got a recorded message. But the Canadian Liberty Net, I took a card I bought for $200 called Big Mouth, of all things. You put it in a computer, put a phone jack up to it, and then you could record 20 messages. Press 1 to hear from American groups. Press 2 to hear from Canadian groups. There was 20-odd messages about the Holocaust, about immigration, about a whole variety of different topics. And there was a Canadian Human Rights Tribunal who said I violated the act, and they found me guilty of violating the Human Rights Act in Canada, and I appealed it and went to the Supreme Court of Canada on two separate occasions for that. So that was the Supreme Court. Yes and no. Like it was, I can tell you about it after. It's kind of a long story, and the basic gist of it is they ordered me to shut the phone line down. I moved it to the United States where it was outside of their jurisdiction. They said I was violating the injunction. I said I was complying with the injunction. In the end, they found me guilty of violating the injunction, but said the injunction should never have been granted in the first place. So it was kind of a win and a loss. In an era of a demand of hate via the internet, how can we reach individuals like Dylan Roof? Our exit strategy is different for those who are radicalized online. That's this whole field of de-radicalization and disengagement and the online radicalization, it's all fairly new. So we're actually at some of the forefront of the research in working on that. We did a research grant. We're in the third year of a three-year grant with the Department of the DOJ. So they have the National Institute of Justice is the research arm. So we looked at building a tool to help measure and assess. If somebody says, hey, I'm a former, I used to be in a hate group. What does that mean? I left yesterday. I left 20 years ago. Are they some pathways, some people go actually from extreme right to extreme left. And instead of hitting people in the head with a pipe because they're not white, they're hitting people in the head with a pipe because they're racist. The anger and the antisocial nature of it is the same person. They've just found a different ideology to act out their rage and violence. But the online one is interesting, especially we've just applied actually. Tomorrow our grant application goes in. We're part of a research group to look at that online radicalization and actually to look at it from a mental health perspective as well. And because what we anecdotally see is that there seems to be a higher prevalence of like autism spectrum in some of the cases that we're coming across. So I think, you know, people like Dylan Roof, there's clearly some issues there. So we're trying to explore and look at that. And we put on, you know, counter messaging and reach out to people that are, because we can identify who's radicalizing. The technology it's scary, actually, when I hear about it. But I can tell you that last October, 775 people in Alabama asked the question on Google, how do I join the Ku Klux Klan? And when you cross connect it with publicly available data, just like advertisers do, you can actually narrow down who those people are. So, and then you can reach out to them and try and intervene. There's an interesting program out of Yale where they're playing around with AI and Twitter bots. And what they did is they targeted some people that were trolling and hostile and insensitive and dehumanizing online, and just the Twitter bot would say, you know, that's another human being on the other end of that, right? And just little things like that. And they, over 3 months, they dropped the abusive and intolerant tweets by a third. So there's all kinds of things being tried. It's all just, it's new for everybody. You spoke about a meeting at Google Corp. What is Google doing with the info they've learned from the meeting? So Google Ideas then funded a think tank. They created the Against Violent Extremism Network, which I think is ave.org, which is like a hub for practitioners, for formers, for law enforcement, for government, whoever, academics, to from around the planet to get together. And they funded this Institute for Strategic Dialogue, which has then gone on to fund other projects. And they helped us do some of the counter messaging. Google doesn't do it directly, but they've trusted different groups to finance and fund new and innovative methods to combat this stuff. So they're on to doing other things right now, but they still support those initiatives, which have been, they were essential to us growing and becoming a not-profit and not-for-profit and gaining the experience and the network necessary for us to be effective. You spoke about a meeting. Oh, that's the same one. What might be different in recruiting or reaching out, trying to change someone who grows up in a family or children of hate? That's a great question. And there are differences. But anecdotally, we also see people that have grown up in it, they tend to want to get out of it. It's they've lived in the dysfunction. And as children, as teenagers, they're very much into it. And then by the time they sort of hit their late teens and 20s, they want nothing to do with it. And I can think of two high profile. One was, I think they were twins. They were singers. They were blonde. They were about 12, I think, when they first came on the scene. Blue eyes, and they were known as Prussian Blue. And they would sing, and their families had them all into it. But by the time they got to their late teens, they were into different music. They were into smoking marijuana and wanted the freedom from that oppressive type of family. So, and then Don Black, who created Stormfront, his son, who was going to be the next prodigy of his Stormfront, is since about 95 has been an online forum, and there's probably a 250,000 white supremacist exchange ideas and stuff there. And his son was going to be the next up and coming prodigy, and he's walked away and disavowed the movement. Tom Metzger's son, I think, did the same. He sort of disappeared into obscurity. So there is a difference, but we have to adjust to that. What groups do myself work with? Just white supremacists? Generally, that's the case, because that's where my experience is, and I can speak to the specific issues. But having said that, in our formers group, we have Sikh nationalists. We've invited people in that were former. There was a guy who created a website, American Jihadi, who threatened South Park and went to prison. He was a convert to Islam, and I spent time with him and listening to his story. It was the same as ours. The ideology is almost, it's like the last piece that goes on top. The rest of it's all human stories. It's like the human condition, And they're, they all seem to be people that need to be, have the desire to be healed. How can we find the haters online and communicate with them? I think that one's been answered already. There's tools that have been developed to identify those people. How come the law doesn't intervene when violence occurs? And when it does, how is the movement affected? Did you or your colleagues ever deal with law cooperate with law enforcement? In order for us to be effective at what we do, we have to be able to develop a trust relationship with the people that want to leave. So we do not get involved in sharing intelligence with law enforcement. Somebody tells us something, we don't, unless they tell us they're going to hurt themselves or someone in the future, we operate under duty to report, but we're not an intelligence guy. We're not like the SPLC. We work with them, but we don't share intelligence. Our primary thing is to get these people to stop harming other people. So often with counter-narrative and de-radicalization programs, they kind of work on the preventative side, and they try and stop a young person from joining. But once the young person joins, often they go, we missed that one. Let's go and try and stop this next batch. But eventually, in most cases, there's a window that people stay in the movement because it's so dysfunctional. And there's a point where they will become disillusioned anyways. And the ones that stay in it for life, you can tell. They're like really bitter, angry, old, hollowed out men at the end of it. And we could take that window that might be 15 years for someone and get them to be disillusioned in 6 or 7. That's 8 or 9 years of harm reduction. So often we focus on trying to provoke disillusionment and to get them to doubt the value of staying where they're staying, and that's the first step. Does your work with helping people leave the hate community draw it all on 12-step principles such as making amends? That is a great question, and one of the programs developed by one of our founders, who's actually a Latino, Sammy Rangel, who was with Vice Lords or Latin Kings, a gang in Chicago. He spent 7 years in prison, most of it in solitary, and was considered one of Wisconsin's most violent inmates. He's since got a master's in social work, has been running prison reentry programs for the last 15 years, and he created a program based on a modified 12-step program called Formers Anonymous, dealing with addiction to the lifestyle, the dealing with the identity aspects of it. It works with formers and gang members, and it's quite effective. I've never been to a 12-step program, but I remember reading in John Bradshaw's book, Healing the Shame That Binds You, he was a big proponent of 12-step, and he kind of broke it down into layman's terms of what the steps are, which making amends is one of them. And I think I've done 9 of the 12 based on his definitions. It's an important, very important piece. I remember that story that I told you about the gay man, and I was doing some leadership and speaking training. It was like a year-long program with Dov, my mentor. And he goes, okay, I want everybody to think of the most shameful story about themselves. And that was what came up for me. And he said, I want you to go and tell that story in front of the class. And I couldn't tell it with any emotional connection to it whatsoever. I couldn't feel shame. It was just me robotically saying it. I couldn't connect to it. I didn't want to connect to it. And he made me tell that story over and over and over again from his perspective, from my perspective, until I could connect emotionally to the shame and everything about it. And it went on for 2 hours. I feel sorry for the class. I had to sit in front of it. I had to do it like 20 times in a row before I could actually connect to it. And it was a couple weeks later, St. Patrick's Day, and I was at a party, and there was 4 gay men there. And I said, just for whatever reason, it just grabbed a hold of me. And I said, here, I want to come in this room. And I told them that story and asked them if they could forgive me. And I said, I know I didn't do it to you, but I did it to your community. And I know that there's things that were done to you that no one will ever apologize for you, to you about. But I can apologize for this. And I'm crying. They're crying. One guy wasn't crying. He was angry and had his arms crossed. And that's okay. I mean, forgiveness is for them. It's not for me. I can't demand or ask forgiveness of anybody. But I can create situations where they can heal through it. And okay. And so that was a really profound thing for me. And a couple of those guys have been great friends, and we still hang out and stuff ever since. And I know it was healing for me. It was healing for them. And it was a really powerful moment. And it's critical that we include the voices of victims and survivors whenever we talk about any of this stuff. What do you know about Breitbart News' connection with the neo-Nazi movement? I don't follow Breitbart News that much, so I can't speak specifically to the connection, but it's all part of an overlapping spectrum. And you've got, you know, conservative groups, alt-right, that are concerned about immigration, and you've got people that don't believe the Holocaust happened and would like there to be one now. And the people traverse different groups. There's nothing new about the alt-right except the label. I know that at my time in the movement, I was telling people, and a number of people were saying the same thing, grow your hair out, stay out of the violence, don't get tattoos, don't go to membership groups, go to college, go mainstream. And, you know, 20 years later, you have guys like Richard Spencer, right? And the violence isn't there like it was in the 80s and the 90s, but the dehumanization and the attitude and the ideology is exactly the same. Extreme ideologists seem to run in a pack. Is that from fundamental insecurity? Absolutely, right? For like I said, for someone to hold that ideology of dehumanization, they have to be dehumanized themselves, and they have to. I had a false sense of bravado, and I got it fed with my association with violent people that created fear. I got it fed by wearing patches that would terrify and horrify people. It was, you know, think of like a puffer fish. You know, it was a mask I was wearing. Behind that mask, I was a weak, sensitive, terrified little kid. But a wounded, terrified little kid in an adult's body can still be damn dangerous. I think this is the last one. There's a lot of hate since November 2016, not a single personal problem, but a country being overtaken. My comment on that is it's true, but the hate's happening on both sides. And I don't think we can address the dehumanization on one side without addressing the dehumanization on the other side. And there's no middle ground. There's just two engines of dehumanization in echo chambers filling the room. And that's a frightening thing, because we can't afford to dehumanize anybody, even if they voted for Trump. They're still human beings. They still had their reason, whatever. I'm not saying that what they did was right. But if we don't think that they're human and we write them off and it's okay to hit a woman with a Trump hat on, that the second we can justify violence on those type of levels, we're a society that's in trouble. And when it's happening on both sides, that's even more trouble. And I think of in that with Martin Luther King, who inspired our group. And with Martin Luther King, I'm going to paraphrase him here, but you can't defeat hate with hate. Only love can defeat hate. You can't defeat darkness with darkness. Only light can defeat darkness. And I think we've forgotten that. And I think for this nation to heal, we have to have compassion for the people who we don't think deserve it. And the hardest thing is to have compassion for someone who has no compassion. I think that's the last question. Thank you very much.